The first piece that we'd like to start with is to just get some basic definitions on the board about what we mean when we're talking about the topic of prayer. It can mean so many different things to many different people, and so we try to look at some of these earliest ways of thinking about it. One that's very common is the idea of prayer as a form of communication between the human and divine elements are involved here, sort of like a conversation that we might have with another person, but in a radically different kind of a context with many different important challenges that make it not just like a conversation. It's a very special kind of conversation, not the least of which because of the incredible power differential that is experienced by the person offering the prayer, because they bring the prayer with the expectation that God could do something if God so desired. This is very different than a conversation with a friend where we might complain about something, but we don't really believe the friend has the power or the inclination necessarily even to change something. So there's a very important difference that prayer as communication is a very special privileged form of communication. We can also think about prayer not necessarily as that communicative level, but as a broader sense of connectivity, a way of establishing points of contact with either the self, with the individual, what is my own spirituality like, and so in this way prayer becomes a way for me to connect with my own spirit. Prayer could also be a way for me to connect with someone else's spirit or with the larger physical world. Prayers about the environment or prayers for healing for some other person. It might also be the case that prayer has to do with a sense of connection with the divine. So it has to do specifically with, if you think about prayers of adoration or praise or thanksgiving, that are specifically about how it is that the individual is connecting with the divine element. This is also a point where we talk about the idea of prayer as having some sort of a specific theistic kind of direction to it. Now, this very quickly sort of isolates prayer within specific kinds of religious traditions, right, and not others. But we think it's important to draw this line so that the word prayer means something instead of everything. If we talk about just this theistic kind of a concept, these senses of connection make more sense there. The sense of communication makes more sense. One of the places that we sometimes find difficulty then is drawing the line between prayer and meditation. And for the purposes of our studies, we typically draw that line and we say meditation, by and large, in the type that we're referring to, meditation does not have a specific theistic sort of a concept behind it. It's a different way of engaging. Now, there can also be prayer that is meditative. Right? Because it might be in the midst of the meditation there is a theistic constant, right? And so it's difficult. The word meditation sort of can come down on both sides of this. And we will talk about meditative prayer, but then there are a whole other variety of more, typically more Eastern sorts of meditations without the theistic concept. We set those aside and we say, we're happy to talk about them, but that's not what we mean by prayer. And again, what we're trying to do is just narrow down the definition so that we can understand more specifically what it is that we're speaking of here. One of the first things that it becomes very apparent, whether we're thinking of communication or connection, is this idea that prayer is multidimensional. One example of this is many people are familiar with the Pater Noster, or the Our Father, the Lord's Prayer. Right? Our contention is that the Lord's Prayer is not a single prayer. That instead, the Lord's Prayer has a whole variety of different kinds of prayer within it. Some of these moments of prayer are about adoration. Some are about thanksgiving. Some are confession. Some are supplication. And so when we see studies that say we're going to have people pray the Lord's Prayer, we think conceptually this is not a good move. Because why? Because the Lord's Prayer has so many different things going on in it. That if we're doing, for instance, an MRI study and people are praying and it's the Lord's Prayer, we say we don't know what that means because there are so many different things happening during that. And so we try to restrict this to more specific kinds of prayer within there. We also think about the multiple dimensions of prayer in that it has the ability to act in these different ways. in some ways, the kinds of prayers that people utter, that they are giving forth, have to do with local sorts of needs. Things that are about me and my community within a very limited sphere. But in other ways, prayer is a very non-local. It can be very global. Think about world peace, sort of a prayer. This is something that is much larger. And this is a helpful dimension that Jeffrey Levin talked about back in the mid-90s, about this idea that prayer can either operate on this local level or this non-local level, and it becomes another dimension by which we can think about how prayer is working. We also think about prayer on a physical and a metaphysical, or physical and a supernatural or a supraphysical dimension. Because in some ways, the prayers that people utter are for very physical things to take place. My leg is broken and I'm praying for healing. That's a very physical sort of a prayer. But if, on the other hand, I say, I think I need forgiveness for the thoughts that I have had, or for the things that I have contemplated, or other sort of more supernatural, non-tangible elements of my existence. Another dimension we can look at for prayer is this movement between the physical and the metaphysical sorts of prayers that we utter. So, many different ways that we think about prayer, but it becomes very important for us to think about these different pieces. And so when we think of frequency of prayer, as in Jesse's study, right, we get the very first blush. People are engaging in the practice, but what we're trying to do with this research program is push further and say they engage in the practice, but they might be praying for their grandmother to live, or they might be praying for their grandmother to die. Does that make a difference? Probably. Right? And so we try to get to some of those levels of importance about what's going on during the prayer. One of my favorite examples, there's you're familiar with country western music in the United States? A beautiful song. He says, I went to church for the first time the other day, and the preacher told me I had to pray for you, even though we had broken up, right? He broke up with his girlfriend. It's a classic country western song. They always break up with their girlfriend. He says, I broke up with my girlfriend. The preacher told me I had to pray for you, and so I did. I prayed that the brakes on your car would go out on a steep hill. I pray that a flower pot will fall on your head as you walk under the windowsill. Yes, I'm praying for you. It makes a difference what kind of prayer is going on. The next portion of this talk thinks about spiritual care. This is a word and a concept that we've had bandied about quite a bit at this particular conference, and I really wanted to get at the nub, the core of this. And this is something I know that is going on here in many different countries as we try to think about spiritual competency or competencies of different areas of specialization within healthcare. And you have to articulate what is it that is unique that you bring to the table as a practitioner in healthcare. So I thought this is very timely. One of the most frequent definitions I get from my friends who are actually engaging in this is that spiritual care is what a spiritual leader does. From a philosophical standpoint, from a logical standpoint, I find this relatively unsatisfactory answer. This is not very helpful to say it is what someone who is spiritual does, because it just moves in this circular sort of a pattern and doesn't really give us any sort of an explanation.
You also assume the pastor is spiritual.
You assume that, as we say here, that there's some sort of a theistic construct there. Is that part of spiritual care or not? Does spiritual care have as a subset theistic, but as another subset non-theistic? Probably. And so it's difficult to articulate it just as what a pastor does. But it's also difficult to say it's what a spiritual person does, because that's equally circular. Is spiritual care, as Bob Emmons might say, or within a more humanistic tradition, the positive psychology tradition, might say that spiritual care is about communicating with others about their ultimate concerns. What is it that is truly important to these individuals? Life and death sorts of issues. But how does it become spiritual care in a particular sense? Is it spiritual care then when I talk to my friend? Am I doing spiritual care at that moment? Or is spiritual care something that is more specialized in some way? Or is spiritual care just a human thing, being nice to and compassionate with other people? If it's just a human thing, we have difficulty saying how it comes under the umbrella of healthcare as a specialization. And so it's a challenge for us. Is it just spiritually sensitive counseling? In other words, do we appropriate different counseling techniques such as Gestalt approaches or any other sort of an approach, and we say we're being sensitive to the spiritual dimension, so we allow the clients or the patients, depending on your tradition of counseling, to speak about these things freely without shutting them off or discarding them? Is spiritual care just being sensitive to people's needs? Does it give us this sort of status within our social identification so that other people recognize who we are and say, ah, yes, you are licensed as a therapist and you are sensitive to spiritual needs? So it gives us some sort of credentialing within the community. I'm not sure which of those it is. Maybe some of you will be able to help sort that out, but I think that's an ongoing conversation with providers as well, to try to articulate what it is that is being done in those moments. Not a simple task, as we have seen this weekend. The next piece that I look at is, when does spiritual care take place? Well, most often, spiritual care is found in moments of crisis. There's some sort of an intervention that needs to take place. Some tragedy, a major event has transpired, and people come to counselors, they come to therapists, looking for spiritual care at this moment of tragedy. But there are other people who will come looking for spiritual care even before a bad thing has happened. There may be people who are seeking out spiritual care before this tragedy. And in that case, the type of care that we are offering is not an intervention or a triage sort of a system in a medical term. We're not just trying to help put a bandage on something, but we can actually help people to prepare for potential crises so that when something negative happens, they already have the tools or the ability to cope with it effectively because they have thought about it before it became an emergency. These are the people that the therapists, the counselors really treasure, because you know that you're not going to see them in the same sort of a difficult situation because they already have some of these tools. Often we see people after a crisis has taken place too. In this situation, part of the message of the therapy or of the counseling situation becomes that of restoration. How do we bring people out of this bad place back to a place with which they are comfortable? So spiritual care is taking place at different points along people's life trajectory. It takes place in different ways. And what we want to next think about is, how is it that prayer might be important at these different sort of critical junctions within this larger structure of spiritual care? One of the ways that we think that it comes into play is that the expectations people bring with them are different, whether they are at a point of intervention, of restoration, or at a point of pure crisis and triage settings. The expectations people have about how fast prayer should work or how quickly they should feel a benefit from prayer are going to be radically different depending upon why the person has come to us. The desires that the people have for prayer are also going to differ based on these different status with which we see them come to us. And so in some cases, for instance, at the moment of crisis, people may come to a spiritual care situation looking for proof that prayer does work, or alternatively, proof that prayer cannot work. They may have a very specific sort of an agenda that they bring to spiritual caregivers, either looking to prove or disprove what it is that's going on with prayer. It's interesting, in many of these situations that I've described about when spiritual care takes place and what spiritual care is that often in the midst of these, the people seeking the care, seeking to use the prayer or understand prayer, are also at a point where their own critical thinking is relatively weakened. Especially when you are in the moment of crisis, it's very hard to think straight about anything, to think about a logical sort of a progression. And so these people are obviously at a very vulnerable point in terms of their own abilities to think critically. Part of what falls then on the shoulder of the individual giving the spiritual care is the ability to help people and guide them through and to help them restructure their critical thinking with prayer as a part of that moment. Another way in which I have seen prayer used in spiritual care is sort of a professional entrance or exit. And I think in many of these cases, this may have more to do with the caregiver than it has to do with the care receiver. Especially as we look at individuals who are relatively new to the spiritual care giving process, prayer tends to be used as some sort of an official way to start a conversation. It's very easy to walk into a patient's room or to a client's situation and say, "Let us pray." It officially begins and it marks, it gives social credentials to. But at the same time, it can also be a very handy way for a counselor or a clinician, a person giving spiritual care, to bring to an end a session where they are at a loss for what to do. Well, let's pray about this. And this becomes then the official termination point of the session. It's, we are done talking, we are now going to pray, and God will take care of the things that I cannot think of any longer. And so in that way, it becomes something very comfortable for the caregiver to use, but in many ways, this is not a very helpful form of prayer, because it is seen as something that only bookends a particular session or a particular encounter. Prayer is the start, prayer is the end, and what we do in between is not prayer. And I think that may set up a dynamic that is not necessarily helpful at these different stages of spiritual caregiving. I give you two case studies quickly of experiences here. One, a 75-year-old male experiencing cancer, relatively low attendance at religious services, but not hostile toward religion. Very friendly, very open, just that attending at these sorts of things is just not something that he likes to do. And so, as the pastor, go to visit weekly, dealing with the terminal stages of cancer, and lots of conversation that takes place. Eventually, after maybe approximately 2 to 3 months, he dies. And the comment that came back then from the spouse, from his wife, was, "You never prayed with him." An interesting sort of an observation, that in the midst of these conversations, as the pastor in these situations, everything that I was doing with this particular individual was always in the spirit of spiritual caregiving, talking about these ultimate concerns, about issues of life and death. But what was most important for his wife, who was watching, was sort of eavesdropping on most of these, right? Because they're taking place in a hospital setting or in the home setting where care is being given, hospice care toward the very end. So she's sort of eavesdropping off. And what she was really looking for as another care recipient was to watch some sort of the official prayer taking place, right? And so from her perspective, that was something that was missing that was very important. But for him, it was beautiful that prayer was not an official act in those settings. He received a lot of benefit of spiritual camaraderie. He knew that I was the pastor visiting, and so he was very comfortable and very appreciative for that. And also, he was very appreciative that there was not prayer in a formal sort of a sense. And so prayer becomes very different, and as you deal with spouses then, it can become very challenging to meet the expectations and the desires of both of the parties involved in that kind of a situation. Very challenging. Second study. Another male, 82 years old, unknown causes, rapid weight loss, about a 2-year process toward ultimate death, and just many, many tests, and just eventually you do not know what the problem is. This is a fellow does not like to go to churches, sort of has as a hallmark of his existence is that he's highly critical of these hypocrites who are in the churches. And so going to visit him now, I am not officially in a pastoral sort of a role, but as a friend who he knows also has served as a pastor. And so he knows that there is this very highly spiritual element to my own existence. And when he talks to me, he understands that that is part of the dialogue. And so the two of us are back and forth, and again, talking about issues of life concern and things of that nature, but in a very unusual sort of a way. He knows that it's an element, but it is not articulated as such. Many, many visits, especially as he's close to death, and as he's on his deathbed, I make the official invitation, "Would you like to pray?" And he responds, "Not if I was in the deepest, darkest hole in the universe." Right? There will be no official prayer there. The next day, coming back after he's had a massive stroke, and I walk into the room, and it's clear that he is no longer there if we talk about the brain sense, right? His eyes are fixed, the pupils are dilated. It's clearly just a process now of his body shutting down. And yet, another friend of the family comes in and stands beside him, takes his hand, while he is in a position now where he cannot react to anything. He's not even able to move his eyes as such, right? And she says to him, "Don't worry. You will experience love as you've never experienced it before. Jesus is waiting for you. You've had a good life." And at this moment, this man who cannot communicate, cannot move, begins to gurgle, right? And you can hear this welling up inside him that he does not want to hear this. He cannot do anything else, but it's very clear that this offering of prayer, and she stood there and prayed with him, and I'm standing at the end of the bed saying, "Ah, this is not spiritual care for him." But at that moment, it was more about her than it was about him, and her looking for comfort. And as caregivers, spiritual caregivers, it's very easy for us to slip into exactly the same piece where it becomes about us and not about the person. For whom is the prayer? Is it the care receiver? Is it the caregiver? Is it the pastoral visitor who is uneasy in the face of death? Is it God? We have to articulate for ourselves and understand why it is that we're doing prayer. Is it for me to please the wife who I know is eavesdropping, but it would offend the person to whom I'm speaking? It becomes very tricky, but we have to, as professionals, have to articulate this. Why does it take place? This is also something that we must think about, because in many, many contexts that I've heard, both within medical contexts and outside of medical contexts, one of the things that I've heard over and over physicians say is, "There's nothing left to do now except to pray." What this does, again, is it puts at that terminal ending, sort of prayer is the last thing that we're going to try here, or prayer is the first thing that we're going to try, and instead it doesn't make prayer part of this whole experience. It becomes simply reduced to some sort of a formal coping tool rather than being presented as a lifestyle issue, that you live in the midst of the prayer. Prayer as knowing. We talked about this just a little bit this morning with some of Fraser Watts's presentation. This idea that prayer can be of the head, prayer can be very cognitive, or prayer could also be more implicational. It can be more implicit than it is explicit. But I think that there is also a way that Fraser is talking about trying to bring these two pieces together so that the implicit and the explicit, as he said this morning, to have both voices represented. But I think that there's even more than just this implication of being able to bring together these two types of prayer, these two ways of praying, and this cognitive sort of an overlay. I think that there is still something that is beneath what he was talking about as implicit cognition or implicit knowing. Some of the ways that I think this takes place is prayer as how we see things, visual ways in which we engage. One study that we have conducted gave people digital cameras, asked them to take pictures of whatever they thought was spiritually important, and then we analyzed these pictures in relation to how it is people pray. And what we find is that people literally look at the world in radically different ways depending upon, in relation to, the ways in which they engage their prayer lives. their spirituality is linked very closely to how they visualize. This is not just some sort of new information that's coming in, although there is a visual subcomponent within the entire system that Fraser speaks of. I think that it's something at an even deeper level. Tactile. What is it that touch brings to us? What is it that sound brings? A whole realm of psychology, of religion, and healing and spirituality that has yet to be explored in terms of the role of music within rituals and what it is in a scientific sense, but also in this deeper sort of a sense that music and sound brings to us. What is it that we have in terms of our taste, in terms of our sense of smell? He talked briefly and alluded to the idea of smells and bells within different rituals, but I think it's more than just putting it into a ritual, because I think there is another way. If we look at the actual pathways that are going on of receipt here, we find that within almost all of these different sensory organisms, there are very, what are referred to as fast pathways that go directly from, for instance, auditory nerve directly into the amygdala that stimulate very quick, rapid, pre-processed sorts of information that I think underlie even this what they're referring to as an implicit sense of cognition. Some of the conclusions that we can draw very quickly is this idea then that there are always multiple dimensions that we must look at, both of the care that we give, the care that is experienced, and the ways in which we try to incorporate prayer into the midst of that. I think that it's more than integration. And I bring to the table, for instance, experience with patients who have Alzheimer's. As you get to the end stages of Alzheimer's and they lose this ability to communicate in any other way, if you bring in music that they are very familiar with, in many cases I have seen instances of connection that still take place even though everything else is lost. And in some cases, even people who will begin to sing the songs of their youth when they can do nothing else to communicate. And you know that you've gotten through in these particular, and again, these are anecdotal sort of pieces that I say we need to back up with more experiential or experimental long-term kinds of studies. But you see this large smile come across their face, and you have this sense that you have, in fact, touched a place that has not been touched in a long time, and that they are suddenly back with you. Like the man that I was with as he begins to gurgle when somebody's praying and he does not want this. You're touching a place that hasn't been touched, and people find this last moments of expression here. The necessity here then is for truly interdisciplinary work. Many conferences that we attend end up with practitioners like ourselves speaking as a psychologist, as a physician, as a sociologist, an anthropologist. But what we end up doing is having conferences where we talk to each other. Or better yet, maybe, or not better, but more often perhaps, talking at each other. And people hear each other's conversations, they hear the presentation, they walk out the door, and it is though it is some sort of an electronic eraser for the brain, and the hard drive is wiped clean, and we do not think about it any longer. But actually coming together and working across disciplines in a way that learns each other's languages and honors each other's research traditions and investigation styles is something that is critical for us to be able to advance. I'd like to thank the John Templeton Foundation, whose generous grants have allowed me to be here at this particular conference and to share some of this research and the thinking that's gone on behind it.